Hello.
Hello.
Hello. So let's introduce ourselves again. I'm Max Davey.
And I'm Tess Davey.
And we're back.
Yep.
Well, it's been a year since we've done a podcast.
Oh my God.
And this is going out.
Old.
This is kind of a new podcast for us. Although kind it's going
of.
Out on the same feed as the old podcast.
Okay.
So some of you will be listening to us because you previously listened to Extraordinary Brains, which was our and if you just joined the podcast and you're listening for the first time, it's on the feed, 25 episodes of neurodiverse people's lives that we explore and talk about how they've got to where they are now. So some really good interviews there. But this podcast is
science.
It's the ADHD Science Podcast. We're doing it in partnership with the charity ADHD UK,
which
has the advantage that they are going to do the publicity. And if you want to talk to us, ask us questions, then ADHD UK is the way to do it. So their Twitter, their Instagram, their other things, our dog, who obviously makes cameos every so often, is being annoying. And they have a little section on the website where you can submit questions and comments as well. We really, really want you to do that because we've got some brilliant, seven brilliant researchers for this season. We're going to put one out a week. We recorded them all and they're all ready to go. We just need to put them out. And so we want to know what you think of them and what you want to know more following the conversations that we're going to have.
Yes, yes, yes. I don't really have anything to add. I'm just agreeing with you.
Yes, good. Well, that's the first time for everything.
All right.
So we will get straight on without further ado with the first interview with Natalia, whose surname I can't pronounce, and I will demonstrate my lack of pronunciation in the interview when I try and pronounce it. And she's from the University of Cambridge, and she's going to talk us through her research into statistical analysis of the different sorts of cognition and behaviour. But more importantly, I think she's going to explain what some of those things mean and give us a real foundation for the rest of the interviews. Yeah?
Ooh, exciting.
So it's basically seven interviews coming up, ADHD researchers, starting with Natalia.
Follow
Let's
our
go.
Instagram.
Follow the ADHD UK Instagram.
That's what I meant.
Yeah, okay, all right. Let's go! Right, hello.
Hello.
Hello, welcome everyone. We are joined today by Natalia. Next, I'm going to run up at your surname, Zadora Futsova.
Yeah,
ooh,
hi.
I wasn't
Hi, Zadora Futsova. It's very nice to be here today.
So
we're very happy to have you.
Natalia, please tell us where you research and what you're going to talk about today, because it's a fascinating subject to kick off our series.
Yeah, so it's wonderful to be here and also to kick off the series with you. I'm a researcher at the Cognition and Brain Sciences Unit at the University of Cambridge. I'm in the third year of my PhD, so I've been working on this for a few years now, doing my independent research within my lab and also some collaborations with other researchers. And what I'm looking at primarily is the relationship between brain structure, brain function, which I'll explain later if you want to go into more depth about that, cognition and behavior. And specifically what I'm interested in is inattention and hyperactivity and how that relates to different properties of brain networks, as well as cognitive differences that might potentially determine learning outcomes in children and adolescents.
Great. So that's a really great encapsulation of what it is that you're doing. But I thought we could go back really to basics and what do you mean by structure? What do you mean by function? Let's start with that, shall we?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure.
What
so when you're looking at when you're looking at data at multiple levels, you have to be more precise with your definitions. In order to be really clear about exactly what it is that you're looking at. So to kind of start off from the basics of the brain data that we're using, for brain structure, what I mean is MRI scans. And we have a sample of 1,000 children from the kind of east of England, Cambridgeshire area, many of whom are struggling learners. So they've been referred to us at the Center for Attention, Learning and Memory, or CALM, for a wide range of things, not necessarily a diagnosis that they have, but let's say they're struggling in their maths course or they're struggling behaviorally at school. And they've been referred to us and they've gone in for an MRI scan that looks at brain structure, another one that looks at brain activity when they're at rest, so when they're not doing anything in particular, and then also 3 to 4 hours of cognitive and behavioral testing. So we have a ton of data on these 1,000 or so kids. And for brain structure, what I mean is just an MRI scan looking at white matter tracts in the brain. So all the different fibrous connections that keep the brain together and allow information in the form of electrical impulses to travel between different regions of the brain, allowing you to think, coordinate your behavior and that sort of thing.
Just to break it down really basically, if you think about, if you slice through a brain, it's a little bit, I know this is going to offend you as a neuroscientist, Natalia, but if you slice through a brain, it's a bit like slicing through a cauliflower.
Yeah.
And the white matter and the gray matter is the bits on the outside, and the gray matter is like the stems.
The gray matter is like the florets.
Is the florets, yeah. And the white matter,
you're right, that they look really similar, and that's because a lot of things in nature look that way. They look fractal. Exactly. The white matter bit, if you're thinking of a cauliflower, would be the stem and the branches of the cauliflower leaping off of the stem. So it's all of the parts of the cauliflower or the brain that are connecting it together and allowing nutrients in the case of the cauliflower or electrical activity in the case of the brain to be passed through the whole network.
I mean, I should definitely know this, but is the MRI...
I thought it was going to be a cauliflower question.
Okay. Is the MRI the one where they take lots and lots of different photos of different sections of your brain?
Like slices layers, through, yeah.
Slices through, and then they layer them to create a sort of 3D image. Is that the one?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So yes. You go into the MRI scanner. It takes lots and lots of slices of scans over the course of about half an hour in our case, because we're getting a structural scan and also a scan of brain activity at rest. And then what we do to the structural scan is we take that image for each person, and we don't just eyeball it, but we look at the density of these white matter connections. And then we turn them into numbers. So we kind of convert this image that you can look at of a brain, and we convert it into a format that you can actually use within a data analysis pipeline. And this format is typically a matrix or a connectome. I might refer to connectomes during our discussion. And what that is it's basically a matrix that represents how strong connections are across different regions of the brain. And it's a nice way of mathematically formalizing what's otherwise a really, really complicated network that differs so much between people just visually, allowing you to compare the density of white matter connections between people and also summarizing your data in a way that makes sense and preserves the valuable, components of brain structure while, getting rid of things that might unnecessarily complicate your data analysis. So that's what a connectome is. That's what we do to our MRI scans, both structural and functional. And it allows us to essentially look at how brain networks map across the brain and how they connect to one another.
And you've referred to functional MRI scans. So what's the difference there? What makes them unique and how do they look at different things?
Yeah, so a structural scan, it's just sort of a picture of your brain. It's gray matter and white matter, and you can look at either, and that's very interesting in itself. But for brain function, a functional MRI looks at blood hemoglobin concentrations in the brain across time. So we're not actually looking at the electrical activity itself that's going on in the brain, but we're looking at a proxy for it. So we're looking at how blood oxygen travels around the brain, supplying different areas of the brain with oxygen and nutrients, and kind of inferring that relates to the brain activity. So that's what a functional MRI is picking up. And so we do about a 10-minute functional scan when a person is completely at rest. So we have their eyes closed. They're not thinking about anything in particular. And what you notice is that across those 10 minutes or so, you get a distinct firing of certain networks that, that occur by themselves. They're correlated within themselves. And these are called intrinsic connectivity networks. So these brain networks are things like the default mode network, the visual network, the executive network here at the front of the brain. And each one can kind of be looked at independently or compared in their connectivity to other networks to find out interesting differences between individuals. And that's what we kind of get out of the resting state scan.
Yeah. Okay. Does that make sense?
Enough.
I can explain more as well.
I mean, it isn't easy stuff. And so then you talked about behavior and cognition. So I think those are probably two things to, it's definition hour, but I think it's important to have these foundations so we can kind of go on from there.
Yeah, right. It's really good to have clear, precise definitions when we're looking at these things, because I know especially within colloquial language, we tend to refer to maybe behavior or thinking or cognition and get a lot of terms intertwined in a way that makes it hard to do neuroscience research in a way, because you have to describe things more formally and therefore maybe change the way that people use language from the outset. So what do we mean by cognition? In this case, we mean people's test scores on a variety of cognitive tests. So let's assume that the brain is an information processing unit, which a lot of scientists like to think that it is, because it seems to be taking information from the outside world, doing something to it through its electrical activity, and then allowing you to act in certain ways in the world that, you know, basically let you adapt to your environment. And there are multiple different cognitive capacities that relate to different types of information processing. So, for instance, there's memory. You're processing information about things that happened in the past. There's visuospatial reasoning. So you're processing information about things that are occurring in space that you've received through your visual sense. There's language processing, where your brain is processing something about language that you've read or heard through your visual sense or your auditory sense, and multiple different other kinds of cognition that relate back to this information processing idea that I discussed earlier. And there are different tests that you can give people to assess each type of cognitive modality or type of cognition. And people tend to vary a lot in their cognitive ability, both very generally, so in terms of general intelligence, but then also within different cognitive domains like language process, visual spatial processing, memory. And these are the individual differences that we're really interested in.
Okay. Does that make sense?
Sure.
I mean, it's sort of the water in which I swim all the time. So yeah. It's sort of difficult for me to kind of say, go
so
on.
So executive function is one of the main ones if we're discussing ADHD. A lot of the time people talk about executive dysfunction or executive function differences. Executive function is one of these cognitive domains. And you can measure it through a variety of different tests as well, which makes it easier for us scientists to kind of look at these differences between people in a way that is very easily quantified rather than subjective.
And that's cognition broadly. I mean, it might be worth just quickly saying what executive functioning, how you would define it.
Yeah, so executive function encapsulates a lot of things. So maybe it's not the best example of a very clear-cut cognitive domain, but executive function relates to things like attention, whether it's sustained attention or kind of the ability to control attention itself across long periods of time. It also relates to abstract reasoning and planning. And you kind of have these different aspects of cognition, playing out in various different ways across your development and across your life. And variations in these different abilities between people can actually impact life outcomes quite a bit. So for instance, if your executive function isn't you know, as precisely calibrated or maybe not so much in your control at certain points of your life, then you can find it difficult to plan appointments, let's say, or pay attention to really boring lectures at school, things like that. But then on the other side of things, a lot of people with ADHD experience hyperfocus. So that's a case of something that looks like executive function is really, really good, but actually it's just a different manifestation of it entirely.
So that's such an interesting point. I'll go back to hyperfocus in a minute, but just I mean, because executive function is going to come back, I think, because it's such an important concept. For me, it's like the X factor. When somebody has got lots of really good skills, really good cognitive skills, but just can't get stuff done, because can't get themselves together, that's executive function. And it's hard to get your head around, but it's almost that X factor that goes from the rest of your intelligence to actually getting stuff done. It's that, do you see what I mean? It's that kind of the thing that greases the wheels to actually get stuff done. Anything that is in that is executive function. But can you develop that thought, that because hyperfocus is something that is so fascinating, this idea that people with ADHD, I mean, you come across it.
Yeah, not so much anymore, but
you know,
when I was in like year 10, I remember sitting down and just for 2 straight hours working on a piece of homework.
Right.
And I have never spent that much time working in a row, and I just completely zoned in.
Yeah.
And I think I missed dinner or something. It was insane.
That is unheard of.
For me, yeah.
It's an incredible trait to have. A lot of neurodivergent people can engage in hyperfocus, though not necessarily at will. That's the thing. So you don't really have control over it. And that's why we, in the clinical world and in the research world, consider it to be a feature of executive dysfunction. Because you don't necessarily have control over what topic you hyperfocus on, and when you hyperfocus. And additionally, if you're hyperfocused on something for an entire day, you might neglect other tasks. You might neglect going to get a drink of water or having meals at the right time or sleeping. And so it's basically something that varies a lot in neurodivergent individuals, but is also an indication that something's different about executive function.
So that's such an interesting point, isn't it? It's often thought of as like a superpower, but if you can't control it, it's not much of a superpower.
Yeah.
I know I have a lot of neurodivergent friends and loved ones, and a lot of them have actually used this superpower in their careers and their hobbies. So they've gotten really lucky where the thing that they hyper-focus on happens to be something that is profitable to them in some way. So maybe they're an artist, maybe they're a researcher, and they have a flexible schedule anyway. And they can essentially fixate on something for a dozen hours in a row and produce something really wonderful. But let's say that you hyperfocus on video games. Well, that's a bit different because...
I like video games.
You like video games.
Well, I like some video games. I gave up on one last night, so...
Could you not get past the zombies?
I couldn't get past I gave up in the right half. You're correct, Tess. You've seen through it. And so we've talked about cognition, and really that was really great. But then you talk about behavior. So when you say behavior, what does it mean? Because I think it means, I mean, it's such an interesting word because it means so many different things to different people.
Yeah. So of course, cognition and behavior are really intimately tied, because you process information in your mind. And then you act upon it in some way. And this processing can be conscious or unconscious, but your behavior is definitely observable to others. So behavior typically refers to the stuff that people can observe about you consciously and then take record of in some way. And these might be things like hyperactivity. So we can rate the extent to which we think another person is hyperactive, if they're fidgeting a lot, jumping around. There are a lot of questionnaires that we use to assess children in particular on their hyperactivity that are based on traits like fidgeting in class and having a lot of movement in their body and being impulsive and kind of not necessarily struggling to control their physical movement, but just having a lot of it. And then there are other behaviors too that are associated with ADHD. So we can talk about inattention as a behavioral trait. This is something that we can observe about someone. So attention is a feature of our cognition. It involves information processing, but attention can also be thought of behaviorally. So someone can notice if we're behaving in a way that suggests that we're paying attention to what they're saying, or paying attention when we complete a task. So the difference between cognition and behavior is that cognition occurs within a person. It's information processing that occurs in the brain, whereas behavior strictly kind of refers to things that we notice about other people and then try to quantify so that we can look at interesting differences between people.
It must be very hard to turn into a number, though, to quantify it, because it's so subjective.
Mm.
It definitely is.
Very hard to measure.
And that's why we try to use big samples, because then we have more data. But then you still kind of run into this issue of, you know, a person might behave completely differently at home versus at school. So if you get a teacher to complete a questionnaire, it could totally conflict with a questionnaire completed by someone's parent. And even that's really subjective, because you're rating your child based on what you know about children, and that might be completely different from another person's experience of what children are typically like.
Mm. And compare them to their siblings. I mean, in our house, the standard, you have to be quite hyperactive to be counted as hyperactive.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Neurodivergence occurs in families, so often you get
it
families
does in
of,
our family.
Of everyone being neurodivergent, both parents, all the children, and so everyone kind of seems typical, even though on a population scale, that might not necessarily be the case.
Yeah,
100%. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely genetic in our family, isn't it?
80% prevalence of ADHD, Tessie.
That's true.
80%.
Depends on counting the dog.
Okay, yeah, I can't work it out how out six. I'm not good enough at maths. So that's a really great introduction to the whole field, actually. But we need to sort of drill down to... Do you want to do the first question?
First question.
So just for listeners/slash viewers, we're not going to go on so long, but I think it's really useful to have had that opening 20 minutes or so.
Yeah.
But we're going to drill down to your research, what you're asking, and what you find in your after that brilliant intro.
Mm-hmm. So in your research, what question were you asking?
So in my most recent paper, which actually the online version just came out today in Cortex, which I'm really excited about, it's called Exploring Neural Heterogeneity in Inattention and Hyperactivity. So to break that down, neural heterogeneity. Neural refers to brain. Heterogeneity means diversity. We're looking at neurodiversity in inattention and hyperactivity. So how are people's brains diverse along a spectrum of these two traits? And we had a sample of about 300 children, so it's a very inattentive and hyperactive subsample of our regular sample that we use in my lab from the Center of Attention, Learning, and Memory.
Which, by the way, has got a brilliant acronym, CALM.
CALM,
that's such
yeah.
a great acronym.
So we've got the CALM sample.
So good.
What I've done in the bulk of this paper is I've selected a subsample of kids who are particularly inattentive and hyperactive. So they have a questionnaire score on the Connors questionnaire that shows that they're kind of at the extreme end for these two behavioral traits. And then I used various different statistical techniques to look at different profiles of brain structure within these kids who are very, very behaviorally similar. So at this point, does that make sense?
Yeah. How are you doing, Tess?
I'm okay.
Let's go back to cauliflower.
I'm quite tired at the moment.
Yeah, no. Let's go back to cauliflower. So you look at the size of the cauliflower and you kind of compare, you do a graph of the size of the cauliflower stems versus how hyperactive someone is or isn't.
That makes sense.
Right.
Yeah, so we did that at the very beginning across a much wider range of our sample, so including people who aren't particularly inattentive and hyperactive. And we didn't seem to find anything about brain structure that coincides with the linear variation in inattention and hyperactivity across everyone. So there's no specific part of the brain that determines across the entire population how inattentive or hyperactive people will be.
So that's really interesting, because there's lots of things in the kind of popular, not even the scientific, but the sometimes in textbooks or sometimes in kind of talks about ADHD given by non-scientists or even and even by clinicians that, you know, the prefrontal cortex is particularly important and it's all about the frontal cortex. But I'm a bit skeptical about that, honestly, because
I'm also skeptical about that. I think that when someone is neurodivergent, it's a difference that occurs from the very earliest points of development and that can be seen across the whole brain rather than any particular region. So it might be the case that at the very early stages of development, for genetic reasons, for instance, someone developing in the womb and you have the very earliest version of the brain has a difference in their prefrontal cortex or in their visual cortex or in some other part of the brain. And that gradually, as that person develops and they interact with the world, then that initial difference in one area starts to affect other areas of the brain. So by the time that they're heading off to nursery or they're in school and we see differences in their learning outcomes or their behavior, basically the difference that coincides with their ADHD or coincides with their neurodivergence is something that characterizes the entire brain rather than just one region that we can point to and say, aha, that's what's causing your ADHD. There's no such thing. We have to kind of look at the entire brain and look at how the properties of its connectivity vary rather than trying to outline a strict region that might be different.
So that is so interesting.
That's such an important point, isn't it? So that's a negative finding, and I love negative findings in science. I think, you know what I mean? We get very fixated by positive finding, but I love a good negative finding. Did you? What else have you found in terms of maybe positive findings or
yeah? So we didn't find this any singular component across our entire sample. So we thought, well, if it's a whole brain difference, let's look at kids who are solely very inattentive and hyperactive and study the properties of their brain networks and specifically look at whether or not there are subgroups of brain network connectivity within kids who all share a common behavioral profile. So we took our subsample of about 200 kids who are very inattentive and hyperactive, and we ran a clustering algorithm. So we don't necessarily have to know what that is. A clustering algorithm looks for distinct clusters that are similar to each other within a sample.
And we fed sorting people into groups.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's just a statistical technique.
Color or shape.
Yeah. And it methodically kind of goes through the sample. It looks at brain network data and tries to find subgroups of brain network connectivity, structural connectivity. And here we can call them neurotypes. So we're looking for distinct neurotypes within a sample.
Just to go back to my metaphor of sorting buttons, I'm not saying you're sorting the children by color. I'm saying it's like if you've got like a jar of buttons, you're sorting them you're finding different ways to sort them out. You sort the children by shape and color. It's a metaphor for buttons. I'm trying to kind of explain we'll stick with clustering algorithm, shall we, Tess?
So,
oh my God.
I guess if we're to use our cauliflower analogy, let's say you have a huge barrel of like 200 cauliflowers. We're looking for groups of cauliflowers that are more similar to each other than to whatever other group we select. And the really nice thing about this algorithmic technique is that we don't really have to make any assumptions about our data. It's very data-driven, which means that we're not assuming any differences from the start. We're just kind of letting it run and seeing if it detects distinct subgroups within our sample. And what we found is really interesting. So
please tell us what you found so we can stop talking.
So within our group of very inattentive and hyperactive kids who were also similarly matched on all the other behavioral questionnaires that we gave to them, we found two subtypes of brain structure. Okay, so these kids are behaviorally the pretty much the same. If we had them in a school environment, they would get the same types of behavioral reports from their teachers. If we took them to a clinical environment, it's very likely that they would be given the same range of diagnostic labels. However, there are two brain profiles, and these weren't determined by age, and they weren't determined by gender. So that's really interesting. And this led us to question, okay, so what actually differentiates these brain subgroups or neurotypes within a sample of kids who are highly inattentive and hyperactive? And it turns out that what they differ on is their cognitive ability. So while they didn't differ on their behavioral traits, they exhibited differences in their scores on visuospatial reasoning tests. So going back to what we know about cognition, visuospatial reasoning is a type of information processing in the brain that takes sensory information from the visual sense and kind of tries to think spatially about the world. And it turns out that this type of measure also tracks the extent to which a person can engage in complex abstract reasoning. Things like mathematics, planning, just realms of executive function that we're probably familiar with in the more colloquial sense. So we have inattentive hyperactive kids, two brain subgroups. One of them is slightly better at cognitive tasks that measure visuospatial reasoning than the other group. And that in itself is really fascinating. So we're kind of finding two brain subgroups of people that might get an ADHD diagnosis. They differ in their cognitive ability. But then when we actually looked back at their brain networks and tried to figure out what actually caused this initial split, what differentiated the brains in the first place, primarily it's a brain network measure called communicability. And what communicability refers to is kind of the efficiency with which distinct regions of the brain network as a whole, the whole brain, facilitate information flow. So we don't have to get into the nitty-gritty details, but we computed communicability values for each of the brain regions within our connectomes, within our brain networks, and found that these two groups are primarily differentiated by that measure. So there's a connection between brain network communicability or information processing and performance on cognitive tests, where the group that had higher cognitive test scores also had higher communicability within their brain networks, allowing efficient information transfer. So it's kind of a novel finding.
The better connected the different bits of the brain, the better that the person was at solving these abstract problems of the type that you see in school in a lot of education.
Yeah, and not necessarily more connected either, just sort of more efficiently connected. It's like if we think about a network of trains or roads, you can have a lot of connections, you know, in your railway system,
Junction, for instance.
But that's not necessarily efficient.
It's certainly not.
But if you have big hubs of activity, like King's Cross St. Pancras or Newcastle or York, where a lot of trains go, and they all stop there and allow people to get on and off and connect to other destinations, then that's a good indicator of communicability within a network.
Okay. Good example.
I don't spend enough time outside of where I live to understand any of these references.
Clapham Junction. No, you've probably never been to Clapham Junction.
I doubt
it. It's one of the busiest stations in the country, and it's tiny. Anyway, it's a very good example of a very small space and lots of stuff happening. Okay, sorry, Tess. So
doing my job.
I don't understand about trains.
Okay.
Why should you understand about trains? So the two different groups, I suppose my obvious question is, does this make a difference to their outcomes? But you might not have looked at that yet.
We don't quite have data on that, or at least I haven't probed enough to necessarily assess that about long-term outcomes. But you'd expect that if you have worse cognitive performance on certain reasoning tasks or tasks that are really closely associated with things like mathematical ability, planning, executive function, then you might gradually come to experience worse academic outcomes. And that's interesting because these kids in our sample, again, are behaviorally comparable. So they behave in the same way. And we can assume that if they went into the clinic, then they would all be given a diagnosis of ADHD based on their high levels of inattention and hyperactivity. But one subgroup experiences significantly worse cognitive test scores on these specific visual spatial reasoning tasks than the other one. Both are a bit lower than the age expected average, I should note. So both of these inattentive and hyperactive subgroups actually have lower cognitive test scores than what would be expected for them at their age, but one performs significantly worse than the other. And that might indicate that those kids need more support within school and beyond throughout their learning, basically, in order to feel like they can regulate their behavior and actually manage tasks well. And it's not really considered in the literature of ADHD. So what we know about the current classification of ADHD is that there's an inattentive subtype, a hyperactive subtype, and a combined subtype. That's how it's classified within, for instance, the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders. But this isn't what we saw in our sample. Inattention and hyperactivity were highly correlated, so we're getting more of a combined subtype, if you will, across everybody. And what differentiates kids within that overall group is their cognitive ability, not whether they're more inattentive or more hyperactive. And my reasoning towards the end of this paper, if anyone listening gets a chance to read, is that we should be focusing on data-driven approaches that allow us to learn things about these types of kids to better provision resources for people that might need it. So for instance, those struggling with their cognitive ability at school, because that's more likely to have effects on their learning outcomes and also on their well-being and how they feel about their own ability later on down the line than this rather arbitrary distinction that we currently have between so-called inattentive only and so-called hyperactive only subtypes.
That's so interesting, and it sort of shakes, I mean, probably most people watching / listening wouldn't really care about that, but it's clinicians would slightly rock their world a little bit to have that distinction taken away. Although I kind of agree that a lot of the time it doesn't really matter. I'm aware that some people that I have given one or the other to might be listening as well. So it's still kind of, you know, sometimes it's useful. Anyway,
everyone's experience is different again.
Yeah. Implications, Sal, Tess.
You just called me Sally.
Yeah, well.
That's my mum's name.
I'm not very good with names.
So what does this mean for people looking after ADHD people?
What this means is that we shouldn't just look at behavioral traits, I guess. And we also shouldn't just care about someone's diagnostic label, because there are a lot of inequalities on who has access to a diagnosis. There are enormous waiting lists to be able to get a diagnosis. And not everyone kind of has access to the knowledge that they would need to even seek a diagnosis in the first place. As well as this, a lot of women and girls are often underdiagnosed or misdiagnosed with something other than ADHD. Even though they present with the clinical symptoms, simply because of bias within the system and not enough research on women and girls with ADHD. So we shouldn't just be looking at someone's diagnostic label that they may or may not carry. We should be looking at their behavioral traits and also their cognitive ability, if we're to get a good holistic picture of what a person is like and what their outcomes might be. So yeah, takeaway points would be, don't fixate too much on a person's diagnostic labeling. It turns out that's pretty arbitrary and laden with bias. Look at their behavior, and don't just look at behavior and assume that behavior determines everything. There may also be really fundamental, important cognitive differences that drive how a person interacts with their world and learns and comes to feel about themselves and also their ability.
Yeah, I think for me, as a clinician who does these assessments, it's sort of, Well, it reminds me of the importance of the cognitive aspect of the assessment. So we do routinely some cognitive testing on these kids. And sometimes I think of it as just, well, making sure that they don't have a learning disability. But actually, it's more than that, isn't it? It's what your research suggests is that it's independently important to know what their reasoning ability is, in particularly in the kind of visuospatial abstract kind of way, for their management, particularly in schools.
Yeah, because if we look at general cognitive ability distribution, so things like IQ within the general population and the ADHD population, you don't actually get that much of a difference. So people who have ADHD or autistic exhibit a similar distribution of general intelligence as the rest of us, where, you know, the average is 100 and you have kind of a tapering down the sides of the distribution of people who score lower and people who score higher. But general cognitive ability doesn't necessarily capture subtypes of cognition. So things like language processing, visuospatial reasoning seems to coincide pretty strongly with IQ, but it doesn't determine the full picture. And if we reason that a person has a general cognitive impairment or a learning disability versus they don't have this and, you know, they're fine, then that's a very reductionistic picture to paint, because there might be specific things that they struggle with and other things that they don't struggle with. And we have to be selective about what kind of support we offer. And I know for teachers, it's really, really difficult now to be able to find resources and time to be able to do this kind of specific provisioning. But what we're hoping is that we can fuel research for the future and also kind of contribute to transdiagnostic research right now, research that doesn't rely on people's diagnoses and instead just looks at cognitive and behavioral traits in order to inform better practices, with the hope that one day people will be able to receive more specific kinds of care and support.
Okay, so, I mean, shall we move on to the next question?
Yes, we sure should. So what does this mean for ADHD people themselves?
I guess my takeaway here would be that there is a lot of diversity even within ADHD. Even if we're not just talking about behavioral diversity, there's significant cognitive diversity and even brain diversity. So we can look at people who seem to behave in the same way, and we can't even assume that they have the same type of brain profile. And I think that's really interesting, because when we talk about neurotypes and neurodivergence, we use these words that kind of suggest that there are types of brains that always yield a certain kind of person. And that's not really the case. So we have to be accepting of diversity within these subcommunities and not necessarily make any assumptions about who's the same as anyone else that could hinder research and also hinder efforts to bridge gaps in understanding and foster solidarity among people who are neurodivergent.
So that's very interesting, the point you made about fostering solidarity. Are you suggesting in a way that if we just cling on to I'm ADHD, you're autistic, he's got or she's got dyspraxia, we're in different camps, whereas we should be more thinking about ourselves as actually the variability within those camps in a way?
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to a friend today who is autistic and also has ADHD about a recent encounter that she had where someone said to her, you can't possibly be autistic, you have ADHD. And I said to her, well, you should have told them that there's a 30 to 70% co-occurrence rate between autism and ADHD. And I think that's really important to remember that these categories, these diagnostic labels, they're not necessarily, you know, set in stone or fundamental in some special way. They're just there for diagnosticians to be able to make good choices about what kind of support a person might need. They're not natural groups that exist out in the world in and of themselves. There's a lot of overlap. The boundaries between these categories are really fuzzy. And we can find a lot more commonalities within neurodivergent people than necessarily commonalities within specific diagnostic labels.
So just, yeah. I suppose, just to kind of unpick what that means, because that's a really profound point, isn't it? That neurodiverse people are often more similar to each other. So like two neurodiverse people are often, they may be quite similar to each other, but have different diagnoses. And two people with the same diagnosis can be radically different to each other. I suppose that's in a way. And it's, there's a sort of huge variation within the neurodiverse population, but then another set of variation between the neurodiverse population and the neurotypical population. So there's this kind of complex complex web of differences and similarities going on.
Human diversity is everywhere. We can see it at every level, including within the community of neurodivergent people. So when we look at diagnostic labels, I think we should kind of take them with a grain of salt, and realize that as a whole, if you're neurodivergent, if you experience certain behavioral differences from someone that you'd consider neurotypical or cognitive differences, then it's very likely that someone who has a different diagnosis than you or no diagnosis at all is perhaps very similar to you nonetheless. And we should be looking scientifically at these problems with less of a priority on diagnostic labels. So I mentioned previously that my research uses a transdiagnostic approach, and transdiagnostic means outside of diagnostic boundaries. So we don't recruit participants on the basis that they've been diagnosed with ADHD or diagnosed with autism. We just have a big cohort of kids, we give them all tests, and we compare them on behavioral and cognitive test scores, rather than grouping them in a pretty arbitrary way based on diagnostic labels.
I mean, really having a go at this diagnostic label stuff. I mean, it's what I do. Hang on. Is my job just a complete waste of time?
I should really say that diagnostic labels serve a purpose, right?
They're not
fundamental distinguishing sort of barriers between people that perfectly characterize them in every way. But if someone receives a diagnostic label of some kind that can help them, then it served its purpose. And our job as scientists is to feed into the clinical models that we have and perhaps refine our diagnostic labels so that they can be more useful. So I'm fully behind the application of diagnostic labels, and I think that they're necessary in order to allocate resources efficiently, for instance, which is like a huge part of medicine. It's just that perhaps the specific labels that we have now need a bit of a reboot based on data-driven science, and that's kind of what we're hoping to do.
Absolutely. Okay. I mean, I completely agree with that. I was slightly pulling your leg. Do you want to do the final question?
Yeah. So what's your next question once you're all finished up with this?
So my next question has been looking at resting state functional networks, and that's been the second chapter of my thesis. But my current project, which I think is also really interesting, is looking at brain network dynamics along a spectrum of inattention and hyperactivity. So we're having people go into a different kind of scanner called an MEG scanner, which stands for magnetoencephalography, that measures electrical impulses at the scalp. And I'm looking at how different patterns of firing across brain networks at rest might relate to inattention hyperactivity traits. So that's forthcoming at the moment. We're using a lot of very interesting machine learning and statistical techniques to sort of learn the structure of the data and then compare it between people on the basis of their behavior.
So it's another way of looking at this population and seeing if they fall into different categories. I'm not going to try the button metaphor again. That was a terrible disaster. Okay, well, I mean, that's fascinating. And you must come back and talk to us when you've got some more amazing insights.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Share. If people want to sort of we'll try and find a link to your Cortex paper and put that in the show notes / description. If people are looking to kind of follow your work, I can't remember if you're on Twitter or not, because I sort of met you in person. So
people can always get in touch with me over email. If you just look at the Cambridge Neuroscience web pages, my name is Natalia Zdorovtsova. There's only one person in the world named like I am.
Probably not.
At least who works at Cambridge. You can find me there. And yeah, otherwise on social media, I don't go on Twitter very often, but sometimes I do for research purposes. It's at neuro underscore biologia. So like biology, but with an IA at the end.
Oh, class. That's very nice. That's a very classy Twitter handle. I like it.
I don't think
it.
It's possible to have a classy Twitter
handle. I think it is. And I think you've managed it.
I think if there's anything that can be the closest to classy, it's possible to be with a Twitter handle.
That's
I
it.
I think
okay, fine.
It.
Well, thank you very much.
There you go. All right. Well, thank you very much, Natalia. We've reached the point of the podcast recording when Tess and I start to ramble. So that's always the time. Always. The rails come off our rambling. So it's usually the time to stop. So thank you very, very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And goodbye.
Bye.
Okay, so there was the interview.
There it was.
We won't do too much chit-chat because we've already had quite a long intro. And you're tired and I'm tired.
Hey, that's no excuse. Always stay on the grind.
But we hope that you enjoyed that, and please do let us know via Instagram, Twitter, or the website via ADHD UK what you thought and what questions you have, and actually what topics you would like to cover in future, because we can find somebody who's researched it, ask them to come on and ask them questions about it. That's the genius of this format. All right, I will speak to you later. See you in another week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.